My name is Ralph. I'm an alcoholic. First off, I want to thank Claire and I want to thank the Pacific Group for inviting me to come out this evening and share my experience, strength, and hope. And I want to welcome our new friends to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to let you know, like I know, if you be alcoholic like me, this is probably the best step you can take from the cradle to the grave. And I don't say that because I'm up here speaking tonight. I don't say that because that's what we say at the podium. I say it because this program and this experience and this fellowship and this power I've been introduced to has been working in my life like nothing else ever has before. And I want to thank Jim and I want to thank Hugo for coming up and sharing their experience, strength, and hope with me tonight and breaking the ice. And then I'm going to share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I'm going to do that for a couple of specific reasons. I've been doing this a couple of 24 hours, and the temptation gets to be, like some of you may have heard yourself saying or other people say from the podium, I'm not going to share a long drunk log. Everybody knows how to drink, so I just want to share about recovery. But I remember being new to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I remember sitting out in the group like somebody's probably sitting tonight. And I remember the speaker standing up in front of the group, and he was dressed somewhat like I'm dressed tonight. His clothes were fitting him okay. His eyes were bright. His hair was combed. He was stringing sentences together real well. And I remember thinking to myself, I know this cat has not been where I've been. I know he has not done what I've done, and I know he has not felt what I felt. What can this lame tell me? So I need to let you know that the person that's standing in front of you tonight is not the same one that stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous October 11th of 1986. I weighed about 40 pounds less than I weigh right now on that October 11th. My hair was standing up all over my head. You could smell me way out where the cars are parked, and you guys park a long way from here. You know, And that was what you could see and you could feel and you could smell. And a lot of other things were happening with Ralph that October 1986. I lost a couple of jobs in those last 2 years. I had lost my home. I had lost my marriage. I had lost my self-respect. I had lost the trust of anybody who knew me. And I had lost a couple of other things most of us lose by the time we reach a room like this. I had lost the power of choice over whether or not I'd be chasing it tonight. And I had stopped caring about it. And that second part scared me way more than that first part because I wasn't raised to be what I had become. And real briefly, I'm going to share with you a little bit about my background. I come from South Central L.A. The time I grew up, we just called it Watts. You know, I come from a rather large family, you know, and we didn't have a lot. We stayed in a two-bedroom apartment, and I have five brothers. My mom and dad stayed in one bedroom, and the six boys stayed in three bunk beds in the other bedroom. And my earliest memory of my old man was I didn't like him, and I didn't want to be like him. My father was a drunk. He wasn't violent. He wasn't abusive. My old man was an absentee drunk. And every other Friday, like clockwork, you could count on him not showing up at home. You know, I could remember little kids in the neighborhood who just felt it was their duty to come around and inform my family how my old man had performed the previous Friday or Saturday night up at the pool hall. And I remember feeling embarrassed, and I remember feeling ashamed. And those are feelings I'm real familiar with from an early age. I can remember Saturday mornings and my mom coming up, and I would hear her in the bedroom, and she'd be sweeping up under her bed, and you could hear the ripple bottles clanking together as she swept them out from under that bed, and I would feel so embarrassed and so ashamed. You know, my old man got put out the house when I was 8 or 9 years old. Me and my brothers thought he looked good going, and I never knew till I did inventory how that affected me. But my old man got put out, and my mom started raising us by herself, which was a trip. You know, when I grew up, what I thought family life, ideal families were supposed to be was judged by the television I saw. And I imagine kids who do that today, it's just not as many family shows on. Because when I grew up, you know, family life for me, what a family should be, was depicted by the shows we looked at then. And the shows when I was coming up was Donna Reed, Ozzie and Harriet, Father Knows Best, you know, My Three Sons, and that was not jumping off in my house. You know, when you grow on, you get something that's called perspective. And perspective works like this. You have a mom who raised six boys pretty much by herself. She didn't have a high school education, and your mom put herself back through high school. She put herself through college. She worked two jobs. She took in clothes that she washed and ironed for other folk. And when you look back on your life, you say, damn, I had a hell of a mom. Look how she sacrificed and worked to raise her boys. But when you're a kid about 8 or 9 years old, and you're coming home on a Wednesday afternoon with a couple of partners at about 4 o'clock, and you hit the front door, and mom's is in the living room with a rag on her head and an ironing board up, you don't feel proud, because Harriet was never standing up like that. You feel ashamed and embarrassed, and you stop bringing partners home from school with you, and you retreat into that fantasy world, and you start pretending about what life is really like for you at the house, and you start living in that prison that I've lived in most of my life, and it's the prison I live in sometime even today. And that's the prison of what I think about, what I think you think about me. See, I don't know what you think about me, but I'm trapped in what I think you think about me. And I'll do whatever it takes to shape and form and mold your opinion around. I'll wine you. I'll dine you. I'll woo you. I'll con you. I'll bully you. I'll manipulate you. I will buy you. Please like me. Now, I don't particularly have to like you, but please like me. And I've been out here a few times. Some people probably know, but for those who don't, I don't want you to get this twisted right about now. Somebody sitting out there right now is thinking, this guy might be all right speaker. He's looking around the room, making eye contact with folks. Don't let that fool you. I'm looking for the person who looks like their attention is drifting, look like you're falling asleep. I'm going to work on you. You'll like me before this is over with, right? Trapped in what I think you think about me. And if you're new to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll probably hear a lot of things shared from this podium, because a lot of us came in with some of the same feelings. And one of the common themes I've heard over the years, people get up and talk about they never felt like they fit in growing up. And that's just not part of my story. I'm a little guy, I like a lot of attention. I've never been interested in fitting in. I've always wanted to stand out. And as a result of that, I achieved and I did some things coming up. I'm the kid, I really identify with Hugo when she was standing up here sharing, because I identify with that. Folk coming up to you and telling you, God, you look so quiet. Because I'm the kid, right, growing up, straight A student, class president or student body president, teacher's pet, always the one wearing big glasses from the time I was little, man. And, even though on the outside I had things that seemed like should have made me all right, I was smart, I was class president, I seem to be popular. On the inside, I've always felt like if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. People used to always say to me, too, you look so serious, you look so smart. And on the inside of me, man, I was like, I'm a wild man fighting to get out. But I was square. And I would have did anything to be cool, man. I would have traded it all in to be like some of you guys that's sitting out here. Because the cats who were cool were standing in the bathroom smoking cigarettes, shooting dice. They were cussing. And more important than all that, they had girls. And see, I was terrified of girls. And I lived like that for a long time. Somebody sitting out there right now is thinking, when is this guy going to talk about drinking? Stay with me a minute. So I grew up like this. I'm introverted. I'm shy. I'm smart. I'm good in school. I'm participating in a lot of activities, man. And this is how I grew up. I'm one of the ones that's a late bloomer. For those of you who are early bloomers, those of you who were drinking at 6 and 7 years old, I'm a late bloomer. What can I tell you? I wasn't doing anything until I went to high school. So I'm introverted, I'm shy, I'm smart, I'm all these things. And I go out on a double date this particular night, 16 years old, hadn't done anything. And I go out on a double date. I had a girlfriend. And for me, mind you, having a girlfriend only meant that a friend of mine had asked her to go with me. She had told him to tell me yes, and so now we went together. I didn't know what else that meant, Every now and then we would talk on the phone, but talking on the phone meant you had to have conversation, and I didn't. I was scared. Anyway, nevertheless, so I'm out with my girlfriend this particular night with another guy who was older. He had his girlfriend in the front seat. I had my girlfriend in the back seat. And I really looked up to this older guy because he used to bully me and beat me up. And I just looked so forward for the times when he would accept me. Right? And this night he did because he was going out with my cousin. So he had his girl in the front. He had his girl in the front seat. I had my girl in the back seat. Larry Gray passed this plastic cup of rum and coke to the back seat this particular night. And since he was drinking and I wanted to be like him, I took a drink. And that plastic cup of rum and coke, man, that rum and coke went down real warm and seemed like it rushed back to the top of my brain. And all of a sudden, Ralph's hands started doing things they had never done and his mouth started saying things it had never said. And I had arrived. Alcohol did for me what I couldn't do for myself. It gave me the courage to do and to be and to say things I wouldn't do, be, and say without it. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. In the doctor's opinion, in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, talks about me. It talks about me all throughout that book. And it starts talking about me in the front of that book. In that doctor's opinion, it says something like this. Men and women like Ralph drink essentially for the effect produced by alcohol. First time I read that, I recognized it immediately. Later on in life, when you caught me drinking, if I went to happy hour with the work folk, right, when you try to be on your best behavior, you may catch me drinking some strawberry daiquiris or, you know, some sweet drinks so I don't just totally go there. And sometimes they'd ask me, Ralph, why are you drinking so much? Oh, I like the taste of this. Hell, if I was drinking for taste, I could have stuck with Minute Maid Fruit Punch. I would like what alcohol did for me, you know. I'm not overnight alcoholic. I was not overnight alcoholic. From the time I took that first drink, I understand what it means when it says this disease is progressive. Because my drinking started back then, 16 years old, when I would go to parties pretty much on the weekends, those old garage parties we used to go to. And it stayed that way for a while. I graduated from high school, and I started college in 1971, and I graduated to higher education in every sense of the word. 71, I was still just drinking on weekends to go to parties. By the end of 71, I had started drinking to get ready to go to the party. By 1972, I was drinking not only on the weekends, it had started being during the week. By the end of 72, I was drinking every single day. You know, by the 1973, I was drinking, I was using, I was doing this on a daily basis, and you couldn't have told me it was anything wrong with the way that I was living. Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous has another line in there that describes me. It says, at a certain point in my drinking career, I won't be able to tell the truth from the false. And the way that that worked for me was this. Isn't everybody doing it the way that I do it? Why would you be young, with a bright future, with a little bit of money, financial aid in my case, didn't chasing women and getting loaded come with the territory? You know, in those days, man, if you came over to my house and I couldn't offer you something to drink or something to smoke, I wasn't being a good host. And if I went over your house and you didn't do the same for me, not only weren't you being a good host, I wasn't coming over your house no more. For what? We didn't have anything to discuss. Life seemed real simple to me back in those days. You know, in 2000, you know, and I'm going to speed this up because I really want to. In 2000, we got a lot of things that's out there now. And what? I don't know, it's a lot of people in this room that look like they're from my era, so you know what I'm talking about, the era of free love, you know, that kind of time. And those times and those days just seem so much simpler to me. You know, in 2000, you got to have safe sex, and there's AIDS, and there's sexually transmitted disease. Man, in those days, it was so simple. I would go to a club, I'd have a one-question interview for a girl. You get high? If not, next, I'm moving, you know. Wasting no time, you know, moving on. Somehow I graduated from college and I started working as a counselor for LA City Schools back in 1976. And even though I had the kind of job that should have allowed me to acquire what normal people acquire, I never did. I never did. Snapshot of Ralph's life. Hold on to one fact. This is when it was working. When it was working. And this is just a glimpse of the way that I used to live. I'm the kind of brother, you know, that never had a problem with balancing a bank book. Friday, I got money. 2 days later, broke. Zero. No problem balancing my bank book. No. This part is also a true story. I bought 3 cars, and this is my move. Every time I buy a car, I would make exactly 3 car payments. Then come find it. Just come find it. I got so adept at hiding cars. I thought this is how you parked. Forget a garage. I just parked everywhere, man. Did that 3 cars. I lived in a crib from 1976 to 1979 without paying rent. And I'm working every day. A couple of baffling features about the disease that I suffer from, and one of them is this. I can't see my relationship with alcohol until I'm free of it. I can't see what it's doing to me when I'm in the mix. So some of the things that I'm sharing with you right now weren't so clear to me then. But in the rearview mirror, which is the only time I can truly see my relationship with alcohol, they stand out real clear. One fact stands out real clear to me about those days when it was working. I used to go to work for 2 weeks to live for 2 days. That's why I did it, man, the party. That's it. That's all. I can't tell you the exact day, I can't tell you the moment, and I can't tell you where I was when alcohol turned on me and it started doing more to me than it was doing for me. We call that crossing the invisible line. That's what I hate about the invisible line. It's invisible. Nothing that says when you take this next one, more, you know, and the book talks about that. By the time I realize I'm having a problem with alcohol and need to do something about it, it's probably too late for me to do something about it. Damn. One of the other baffling features about this disease that I suffer from. And I can't tell you when it turned on me, but I can tell you, looking back, some of the things that were signposts along the way. I got married in 1980, had a bachelor party the night before my wedding, got married on a Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock, had a bachelor party the Friday night before I got married. Need to let you know that no other guys were getting married the next day but me. All these other guys at the bachelor party go home at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. Me, the groom, the big, still at my bachelor party till 7:30 that upcoming morning, right? Me and my brothers, four of us in the program right now. One of them is here with me. They take me home from my bachelor party at 7:30, pour me in the bed, get me up at 11 o'clock for my 1 o'clock wedding. Now, mind you, I laid on that bed from 7:30 till 11, just laid toe up. You know, that's why I like coming to meetings almost 14 years later, because I can just say it and folk in here nod, yeah, been there, done that. I'm toe up, right? And so I'm laying on the bed. They get me to the wedding. My then wife-to-be took one look at me wobbling in there. I'm supposed to say my own vows, right? She took one look at me, looked at the preacher, said, scratch the own vows. Say the regular on him, right? So now my lines are cut to two words. So I'm standing at the altar. Standing at the altar, it gets to me. I get ready to say, I threw up all over the altar. Passed out. Have not taken a wedding picture to this day. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Again, to our new friends, if you're anything like me and you come to meetings, there'll be a lot of things shared at the podium that I need some help with from the people that's been around here. Because folk will come up to the podium and they'll share things about, like, a psychic change, the phenomena of craving, allergy of the body, things that are not in my everyday walk-around vocabulary. First time I heard pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, didn't need no help with that one. Folk like us don't need a dictionary for pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I lived pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization up close and personal, and I lived it over and over and over and over again. Because I need to let you know that that wedding day was the high point of that marriage. It went downhill after that. Because I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband. Can remember coming home, sitting on my living room couch, my wife coming out the bathroom real fast, pulling her pants up. Remember her walking to the dining room table and picking the purse up and clutching it real close to her, and walking back to the bathroom and giving me a look, and I would feel this talk, and nobody was in the house but me and her. But it got like that in my house. I'm the kind of husband and I'm the kind of father. Remember coming home and sticking the key in the door, opening the door, and my wife and 2-year-old daughter sitting right there and they're crying. And I look right here, and homeboy's got a gun pointed at my stomach saying, I want my money right now. And I need to go with the men for just a second. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but if you're living out there and you already have doubts when you enter into one of these unions, if you already have doubts about, do I have what it takes to be a husband? Do I have what it takes to be a father? Because if you're in the life, your track record gives you your answer anyway. Because what's the father's role and what's the husband's role? To protect and to provide. And see, I got my house broken into 4 times. Each time I went through the motions of calling 77th Division. And each time I knew when I went through the motions, that's all I was doing was playing. Because the guys had told me, you're going to pay us our money or we coming up in here and getting it. And it's a hell of a thing, fellas, to lay up in bed with a woman night after night after night after night and know that not only aren't you protecting and not only aren't you providing, you the one who brings the wolf to the door. Got like that in my house. I'm the kind of father and I'm the kind of husband can remember sitting on my back porch, my 2-year-old daughter coming outside, pulling in my coat. Daddy, daddy, that's my piggy bank. And me looking at her with a little shitty grin, talking about, don't worry, baby. Daddy's going to put some dollar bills in it for this change. I wasn't raised to be stealing from my wife. Wasn't raised to be stealing from my daughter. I'm an alcoholic with no tools of recovery, and I did what it took to get what I needed to get. My wife started sleeping with the purse up under the pillow, and that was not enough for me. I would lay in the bed, and I could remember those long nights. I'd let that regular breathing set in when she was sleeping with that purse under the pillow, and I'd let the regular breathing set in for a while. Then I'd crawl out my side of the bed, go over to her side of the bed, go up under her pillow and come out real slow. Put the purse in front of my stomach, creep out the bedroom, go to the living room, creep out the front door, jump in the Volkswagen, coast out the driveway, I'm gone. It's Wednesday, I come back on Monday. Did that one too many Wednesdays, came back one Monday. Screen door was locked in the front, screen door was locked in the back. A note on the door said, the rest of your stuff is at your mother's house. Put out my house. I am now my daddy. When I went to stay at my mom's house, my disease really took off, and work got in the way, and I became one of those people who were no longer employed. My whole life and my whole mission in life was just to stay loaded. That's all I did. I entered that underworld of those people who no longer work, who no longer have goals, who no longer have hopes, who walk the streets at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, who live in abandoned houses, and who take things from the people who love them. At the time when I got put out of my house, my wife thought it was something salvageable about this piece of man that she married. She wanted my daughter to have a relationship with her father. So she used to bring my daughter to my mother's house on Saturday afternoons. And I need to let you guys know that I wanted to be a father to my little girl with everything in me. I wanted to take my little girl to Disneyland and Magic Mountain. I wanted to take her to movies on a Saturday afternoon. I wanted to walk up the street with her little hand in my big hand. I wanted to read her bedtime stories and tuck her in bed at night. I wanted to sit her on my lap. I wanted to get the look from my little girl that I've seen men in this fellowship get since I've been in these rooms. To look like this is my daddy and this is my hero. And the best I could do on those Saturday afternoons was 30 minutes. I tell my mom something like I'm going to the store to get Rain something to eat. And I'd disappear. It'd be Saturday and I'd come back on Monday. But I'd sneak back on Sunday nights. And I can remember on those Sunday nights when her mom was picking her up, I'd be peeking around the side of my mom's house and I'd be thinking as the car was backing out the driveway, I'd see those headlights and I'd be thinking, there goes my life backing out the driveway, and I'd be crying. I hear a lot of people talk about they were scared of dying out there. That ain't my story either. I was never scared of dying. I was scared I was going to keep waking up to the same old thing. Monday the same as Tuesday, the same as Sunday, the same as Christmas. Over and over and over and over again. And thank God, God don't make misery comfortable. And I got miserable enough. And I got tired enough that I got directed to a program of recovery. And on October the 13th in 1986, I went to the Harbor Life Center in downtown Los Angeles on Skid Row. I had another brother who was already in there. It was my 4th attempt at trying to get sober through this program. And that night when I went up in there, that night, first night I was in the program, they took me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a man was standing in front of the group, and he was sharing his experience, strength, and hope. And when I went up in the Harbor Light program, mind you, I've not shared with you everything that was going on with me. Didn't share with you when I got put out of my house and went to stay at my mom's house. A check came to one of my brothers in the name of R. White. All of us are R. White. Oh, well. Didn't share with you when I went to stay at my mama's house and grandmama gave me $200 to buy her plane ticket to the family reunion in Atlanta. Had it not been for my mother, my grandmother never would have made it. Didn't share with you that when I got a job, when I tried to get sober the first time, my ex-wife got me a job at a radio station. I stole $1,600 from them, ruined her reputation in the industry. Didn't share with you a whole lot of things. Suffice it to say, I had a lot on my plate when I came up in here. And I was full of guilt, and I was full of remorse, and I was full of, I'll never be able to forgive myself for the things I had done. And a guy was standing up that night, and he was sharing his experience, strength, and hope. And he was sharing about taking from the job, and he was sharing about taking from the family. And I remember sitting out in the group looking at him and thinking to myself, yeah, you sharing about doing scandalous things, but you look scandalous. You should have been doing that. I'm different. I wasn't raised that way. You guys are not going to hear my business. And the speaker seemed like he knew I was in the room because he said something like this. He said, if you are sitting in this room right now, you are not responsible for your disease, but you are responsible for your recovery. And you have just now tapped into a source of power much greater than yourself. And you don't have to drink and you don't have to use no matter what, provided you are willing to fulfill some conditions. Caught my attention. Went on to say something else. He said, this is the only club you can be a member of where the worse off you are when you get here, the better off your chances of staying. And I got the message of hope that first night in Alcoholics Anonymous. He went on to explain to me what I suffer from, that it's something physically different about me than other folks. And me being a smart guy, it seemed like he knew I was in the room because he said, Ralph, don't take my word for it. Diagnose yourself. How many times did you say to yourself, I'm just going to happy hour? What happened? Waitress come around, last call for happy hour. I look at my watch. My buddy said, I told my wife I'm going to be home at 8 o'clock. Yeah, I told my wife I'm going to be home at 8 o'clock. 7:30, my buddy gets up. 7:30, that waitress says, last call for happy hour, and my hand goes up, bring me 9 gin gimlets. And I'm there closing it down again. Ralph, did you do this once? Did you do this twice? Don't look at the times when you set out to tie one on. Look at the times you said, I'm just going to spend 20. Look at the times you said, I just got an hour to kill. Look at the times you said, I'm just going to happy hour. How often did this happen? I did this every 2 weeks from 1979 to 1985, over and over and over again. When I take one of anything, my experience shows me, no matter where I have to go, what I have to do, who I have to see, no matter how great the wish or the necessity, my body takes over and I have to have another one. Well, Ralph, how do you explain, smart guy, my car just seems to drive to the liquor store on payday, second part of this disease, the mental obsession, the obsession that somehow, someday, I'll be able to control and enjoy this magic potion I discovered so many years ago. And check that out anyway for what it really is. The idea that I'll be able to control and enjoy, that's a delusion and an illusion anyway. Because if you're anything like Ralph, anytime I was controlling, I wasn't enjoying. And anytime I was enjoying, I damn sure wasn't controlling. So, you know, the idea that I'll be able to control and enjoy this magic potion. I can't drink because of my body. I can't stop because my mind refuses to accept that fact. I'm powerless. Third part of this disease, spiritual malady. Sometimes it's called a soul sickness. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, Ralph, if you work on the spiritual, the mental and the physical will straighten out. And that's what the program of recovery is really about. That's what the program of recovery is really about. People put a lot of things on it since I've been around here. And if you're new and if you're anything like me, you might have a lot of questions about it too. Some folk call it the work. Some people call it the process. Most of us say the program. A lot of times we just say the steps. What the hell does that mean where I live? What does that mean in my experience? And there are a couple of places in the book where it gives me a line that is just so comfortable for me. It's a manner of living that really works. It's the way I live. Why? Because it really works. I'm not standing up in front of you guys tonight to tell you that the reason I do this thing is because I'm a good guy. Not standing in front of you tonight and tell you the reason I do this is because I'm so virtuous. Not standing up in front of you tonight to tell you the reason I do it is because it's chic to be sober in 2000. Not telling you it because I'm the speaker tonight. I'm telling you that I do this thing because I'm desperate. I do this thing for my life. And I do this thing because it works. And I do this thing because it's fun. Step one, admitted that I'm powerless over alcohol and my life had become unmanageable. I did the work on step one when I was out there. Here, a lot of our new friends talk about I'm working on step one. I suspect if you're anything like me, I don't have to come into a room, Alcoholics Anonymous, and work on being powerless over alcohol. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous based on my experience, and you, 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 and you sharing with me, you know what? I had the same experience with alcohol, and I ain't came back from it by myself either. And it snuffed out the last flicker of hope that I could do it by myself. Step one, admitted that I'm powerless is the problem. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. That's the solution. And that, too, is a conclusion I draw based on my experience. I made a lot of vows to my family. I made a lot of vows to myself. I made a lot of pacts with my brothers. I made a lot of agreements with my wife. I couldn't stop me. You couldn't stop me. If it ain't a power bigger than me who could stop me, I'm in big trouble. I took step two out of desperation, and I took step two out of what do I have to lose? And if you anything like me, and you're new to the program, and you hear people share about, you know, if you want what we have, and you're thinking to yourself, I don't know what you have, and I don't know if I want it, start from the place that I started from. I knew I didn't want what I had. And I took step two out of what do I have to lose. And you know what I had to lose? At the end of my drinking, I was sleeping in the back of my mother's garage. At the end of my drinking, I was taking the trash out for a 21-year-old who lived across the street from me. At the end of my drinking, I was eating lemons off a neighbor's lemon tree for breakfast. That's what I had to lose. I took step two out of desperation. Step three, made a decision to turn my will, which is my thinking, and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of God as I understand it. And I said to my sponsor when I first got to that step, I don't understand God. How am I going to turn my will and my life over to him? And my sponsor looked at me and said, Ralph, it ain't but two things you need to know about God in order to get started. Number one, he is. Number two, he ain't you. And from that beginning, all sorts of remarkable things have happened in my life. If you're sitting in this room right now and you think this program is just about not drinking and just about not using, shortchanging the program and you shortchanging yourself, this program is about a whole lot more than just not drinking and just not using. In step one, it talks about being powerless. And later on in the book, it talks about lack of power is my dilemma. Not having power is my problem. What's my solution? I need some power. I need some power. And that's what this program is really about. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that does for me what I can't do for myself. What this program is really about is about accessing and maintaining a... I don't know what this program is really about, I guess. What this program is really about is about obtaining and maintaining access to a source of power that does for me what I can't do for myself, that can do anything but fail. And what this program is really about, if you want to see it with a face on it, look around this room right now. What this program is really about is it's about taking men and women like us, drunks, boosters, convicts, con artists, failures as mothers, failures as fathers, failures as kids, failures as employees, broken down pieces of men and women who don't have dreams and goals and hopes anymore. It takes people like us, puts us together in one room, and I put one hand in your hand and the other hand in God's hand, and we pick up our beds and we walk up out of these rooms as mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, employees, employers, role models in our community. This program is about growth. This program is about change. If it's going to be any changes made in my life, it begins and it ends with me. You know, and I'm kind of glad that I stumbled a moment ago. I get a chance to do a lot of sharing, and I get a chance to do a lot of speaking. And somebody sitting out there tonight is probably thinking to themselves, this guy must work a hell of a program. Listen to how he's sharing up there tonight. I can't wait to get up in front of everybody and share. Then I'll know I'm working my program. And somebody else is probably on the opposite tack, and they're thinking to themselves, I'll never be able to get up in front of everybody and share. Can I get this thing? And I need to let you know that the ability to share about the program of recovery really ain't got a lot to do with living the program of recovery. This is a living program. It's within the grasp. It's within the reach of anybody that's out there. You know, the thing I like the most about this power, because I'm a very image-conscious guy, I'm a guy, like I told you guys, that wants you to like me. I'm a guy that don't want to make mistakes. I'm a guy that don't want to stumble over my words. I'm a guy that don't want to lose my thoughts in front of everybody. And you know what? I'm a guy that got picked up, touched on October the 11th of 1986, and picked up off the street and out the back of my mother's garage. And I got delivered to a group of people like you, with all my imperfections, with all my scars, with all my warts, just the way that I am. I have a group of people who came out here with me tonight. And this past Sunday, we got on our knees together. And as a group, we said something like, God, we offer ourselves to you to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. And if you come from that place of pain that I come from, or walk in the streets at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, if you come from that place of uselessness that I come from, where you never thought you'd be of value to anybody anymore, if you come from that place that I come from, where getting up to go to work in the morning didn't even come to mind anymore, and to think that you can get on your knees and tell God, I got something to offer to you. And you know what? He won't turn you down. I go up to a lot of people in life, and I've tried to get a resume or an interview with them, and they say, Ralph, you ain't good enough. If you're sitting in this room right now, the thing I like the most about this power that these people introduced me to, he ain't tired and he don't discriminate. What he's done for so many people in these rooms, he's still in the business of doing it. I came in these rooms with nothing. That little girl I shared with you guys about, she's 16 years old now. She just turned 17 3 days ago. And I get the look from my little girl. To look like this is my daddy and this is my hero. I've got a 5-year-old who's never seen her daddy drunk and one day at a time never will. I walked down the aisle again 6 years ago. This time I got the I do out and I had the pictures to prove it. I've been in the same profession for 12 years and they don't want to see me going. And those are the benefits and those are the blessings. And I'm still grateful. And a red light is looking me in the face. And I want to let you guys know here in the Pacific Group, I'm grateful. I'm grateful to you for taking in a scared little boy like Ralph, growing me up, dusting me off, putting me back on a path that really leads somewhere. I'm grateful to the men and women in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to this power you guys introduced me to. And I'm getting ready to sit down. I'll never say anywhere I go that I don't know why I'm sober. I know exactly why I'm sober. I get a blessing so that I can be a blessing. Recovery for me is a gift from God. What I do with my recovery, that's my gift to God. My name is Ralph. I am an alcoholic.